Hi. So I'm Seth McClellan. And today I'll work is I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes or so, and then we're going to watch this silent movie masterpiece, which is an incredibly influential and wonderful movie that was one of the films that convinced people that movies were art. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the day, just like we don't really think of video games as art, right? Most of the people in this room would be like, video games are not art. But if you all were, you would have a different opinion. And that's where movies were at the time when this movie came out in 1928. This is the end of the silent era of cinema, and it's a time when people were starting to create films that changed people's idea of what films could be. That it wasn't just Charlie Chaplin running around, though I think that's art too. And it wasn't some kind of, you know, silly Western or something like that. But that film began to transition from something that was looked at as a novelty in the way that we look at video games, and began to be looked at very seriously as art. And it's in large part because of some of the innovations that this movie made. And that's what we're going to talk a bit about today, is what makes up a movie, and then how this movie was so innovative. So I'm really glad to be here. I came here when I was 8 years old with my dad and my mom and my sister, and my dad was teaching some lectures, and I wrote my first real story here at Holy Village. And they actually performed it the following week after I was gone. And it was like my first real story. And now I'm lucky enough to write stories all the time, and to make stories and to make films. So I'm on faculty at Triton College west of Chicago. And I also, I've made a variety of films. The guy Roger Ebert there that you're reading about, he called a film I produced, Chicago Heights, one of the top 10 best art films of 2010. And I made a film called Came in Chicago. That's a documentary about Dr. Martin Luther King and the Chicago Freedom Movement that played on TV, and I got to interview and hang out with a lot of the leading figures of the civil rights movement. My most recent documentary, and I've made other films and stuff like that, but my most recent documentary is about youth on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, called Little Wounds Warriors. It's about them reconnecting with their traditions. And you can find me on Facebook, and you can Google me, and I have a website. And I say all this not just because being an artist means you've got to promote yourself all the time, but I also say this because this really informs how I'm going to talk to you guys today. It's not so much, I'm going to talk about the historical context, but it's not so much about that, but it's like, how do movies work? What makes a movie? That's what I'm really fascinated by. Is what are these tools that we see in movies, and we see them in all movies. We see them from the first film, like A Trip to the Moon, made in 1903, right? One of the first silent movies that really affected people. And we see it all the way up now to the latest movie blockbuster, and your kid's wedding video. They're all using the same tools. So we're gonna talk just for a minute about this, and then we'll get started. But what tools does a filmmaker have to communicate with the audience? What tools does the filmmaker use? What is a movie made of?
Anybody?
Yeah.
Music.
Audio. Okay, we're going to call it audio. And there's what's called, diegetic audio, which is the audio in the world of the story, like people talking or environmental sounds. And there's non-diegetic audio, which is layered on top, like a music score, right? Layered on top. And audio is such a huge thing, and almost always in films, we're very unaware of how layered audio is. Now, this is one of the pinnacle films, right at the end of the silent era, right? So there is no official audio with this, but what they've added actually is Voices of Light, which is a score designed specifically for this movie in 1995. And this really complements the film because we're very unused to not hearing things. And of course, back in the day when they played a movie, they'd often be like a piano player playing along, kind of improvising. Audio, what else besides audio makes up a movie?
Gesture.
People!
Okay.
Yes. What do we call that? The way people
gesture,
behave, acting. Okay, acting. So, acting's a real big one. So, when we think of acting in silent movies, when we think of the roots of acting, how do people act in your stereotype of silent movie acting? How are people acting?
Over the top.
Yeah. Really wide. Okay, and we call that presentational acting, right? And a big part of that is, you know, A, it's silent, so people are really trying to get their point across. And also, if movies had just been invented and you wanted to hire an actor, where are you going to hire the actor from?
Theater.
The stage! The theater, right? So, on the theater, why do people act more big? Why do people tend to exaggerate?
You can see them.
So that the dude back there can see me, right? If me and you were talking right now, I'd be like, yeah, acting's really interesting. You know, people used to kind of overact. But no, I'm on stage. So I'm here kind of prancing around. So in early cinema, it's still very much rooted in that. And you see presentational acting. The big shift in film acting really came with a guy who started doing method acting. You guys probably remember this guy. My students at college are always like, huh? So who's that guy who created method acting in Streetcar Named Desire?
Marlon Brando,
right? In that very, you know, this very naturalistic style of acting. And that didn't really happen until about 50 years into the history of film. But this film, and part of why this film elevated movie making into an art form, is this film radically broke with that early presentational overacting. And this film has an incredibly, almost terrifyingly realistic screen performance. And that's part of why this film has endured so much and why it's still so famous. It's Falconetti, the woman who portrays Joan of Arc in this movie. The filmmaker did take after take after take. And instead of her doing like big acting, like, oh, I'm Joan of Arc, I'm so upset, right? The camera's just on her in a close-up. And apparently the director would just say, no, stop doing anything. Just look at the camera. And creates one of the most remarkable screen performances in the history of film in this movie. Incredibly vivid, incredibly real, where it's so internal. And that's the big shift in screen acting. From the external presentational acting into this incredibly naturalistic inner lived experience. Audio acting, what else?
Camera lens.
So there's a fancy word for how we use the camera in film.
Cinematography.
There you go, right? Cinematography. And that's just a fancy word for how we use the camera. Now, first movies coming from this world of the stage. How do you think they used the camera back then? If you're thinking of a movie like watching a play, where do you put the camera?
In the front.
There's the stage, right? You set up the camera, it's aimed at the stage, and you're basically recording a play. And early movies are all like this, right? The early silent movies, it's just these wide shots. And people go on stage and run around on stage and they do things, right? But it's all a wide shot. And then, radically, somebody thought, and this wasn't until a few years into silent cinema, somebody thought, what do you think they thought? Instead of a wide shot, why don't we...
Close-ups.
Why don't we do a close-up? And this, like, blew people's mind at the time, right? And the producers were like, I don't know, this is going to freak everybody out. They're not going to like this. But actually, people loved it, right? And this movie, again, is radical for its time because it's almost all in close-up. It's not wide shots. It's not what we call establishing shots. Indeed, radically in this film, there's almost no establishing shots. And by establishing shots, like a wide shot, it's as if we told the story of this lecture, but we just did a close-up of me and you the whole time, right? We never showed the wide shot. And this is radical at the time, right? What else can we do with the camera? We can do a close-up. We can get close in on someone. What else, how else can I use a camera to tell a story?
Lighting
is huge. And lighting plays into some other techniques too, but lighting is huge. It's really stark, beautiful lighting in this movie. Harsh lighting. What else can we do? The lighting and
movement.
This is huge. And this again is radical, right? Is that I'm the camera and here I am focused on you, right? But then what happens if I'm up here? What suddenly does the camera say about her? I'm looking
down.
So is she powerful or weak?
Weak.
She's weak. Right? Now the same thing, if I go down here, what suddenly happens? She's strong and powerful. Again, almost never done in the history of film, this kind of thing. And this movie uses angles radically. It uses them all the time. It uses them to tell the story. Beyond that, this also has camera movements. It's got chaos. The camera goes upside down. The camera in this movie reflects the turmoil of Joan's journey. The camera reflects what's going on emotionally in her. So instead of just a wide shot, like we've seen in most of film history, in most silent films, the camera becomes this dynamic, living thing that's helping to tell the story by going up and saying, hey, look how weak this person is. Or, oh my God, he is so powerful. Or, ah, everything's crazy, right? The camera becomes alive. Audio, acting, cinematography, what else can a filmmaker use? Yeah.
The storyline,
and that's really, thank you. Because we wanted to write something big in the middle of the board. The story is really what it's all about, is feeding this. All of these techniques support the story, support this larger message, this larger theme. Backing up though, and we're going to talk about story again in a second. Audio, acting, cinematography, what else?
Costuming.
Yes, costuming. What else is kind of like a costume?
Staging, prop setting,
right? Like, think about how this changes if we're in a vacant warehouse, this lecture. It changes. It's different. Or think about if we're on the side of the mountain or in the cafeteria. The setting, the staging. Our fancy film word for this is mise en scène. Which, if you speak French, mise en scène, it comes from the theater, actually. It means everything on the stage, everything in the frame. And how these things are arranged. This too is fascinating with this movie, mise en scène. This movie, the director very specifically said, you know what, I'm not going to research what Joan of Arc might have actually worn. We're going to make our own version, because this isn't really about historical accuracy, but it's about capturing and creating a larger truth, an ecstatic truth. What is the truth of the story beyond what was just maybe technically what they actually wore? So they came up with their own costumes. And along the same line, what do actors normally wear on their faces when they go on camera?
Makeup,
right? Why? To look better. To look more realistic and better, right? To look, you know, younger and stronger, you know? And like when I'm on camera, I do acting too. I gotta do my eyebrows, right? Because if not, they don't pop, you know? Like I gotta do that. The director for this movie said, no makeup. I want the camera to be looking at Joan and the characters and her tormentors, and I want it to be completely gritty, real. I want that to be part of the tools to pull us into the film. Also, a great tidbit from this movie is that they built this elaborate set, this incredibly elaborate set that was very expensive to make in this movie. And you never see the set. And when the producers saw the final cut, they're like, so it's mainly close-ups and we never really see the set. And he's like, no, the set was just there for the actors to make it feel for real for them, right? But he's not interested in that in this movie. He's not interested in establishing where you are. Instead, he's interested in saying, what happened to Joan of Arc? What was her journey? And her journey wasn't the way we think of cinema, where we see the environment, but her journey was this internal one. Mise-en-scene, the way things are arranged. Okay, audio, acting, cinematography, mise-en-scene. There's this thing called the invisible art in film. And it's the least intuitive part of film. But what is film on a very fundamental level? It used to be rolls of film,
series
right?
Series of pictures.
Series of pictures, right? Mm-hmm. And then how do they, what do they do to put those pictures together?
Yeah.
They edit them, okay? And editing is our other really big thing. And editing is the thing that you almost never notice. Editing is called, indeed, it's called the invisible art, that you don't notice editing. Mm. Because what do you notice instead of the editing?
What you've left.
The story, yeah, you're just like, oh my God, are they gonna fall in love or not? And you don't notice the technique of weaving these different shots together. Mainly what filmmakers try to do is make it invisible. And by that, they do a technique largely called cutting on action, or seamless editing, where they do a wide shot, and then, as I say, film is great, they cut to a closer shot of me as I raise my hand, okay? So they've got a wide shot, film is cut to the close-up, great! And that tricks our eyes into thinking different shots are woven together into a continuous story, all right? Mainly, they always make editing invisible. But guess what? Not this story. This story relies on the other major technique that editors use. Not to make it seamless, but the idea of juxtaposition. The idea that meaning comes through a combination of shots. Shot A, shot B equals idea C, which is much bigger than shot A or shot B together. So for example, if you took a shot of me smiling, I hope I look nice here, right? Smiling nicely, and then we cut to two little girls on a swing set swinging, okay? That's the sequence, that's the edit. That's the edit of the shot. Smiling man, cut to two little girls on a swing set. What story does that create in the mind of the audience?
A happy father.
He just loves those kids. A happy father, right?
A predator.
Yeah, no, yeah, I know. That's where my students often go when I use that example, right? They're like, no,
the way you smile is creepy.
Yeah, that's definitely it. Okay, but let's indulge me, right? Let's suspend disbelief and go with the happy father. Happy father. Okay, now, if we take that same shot, the same smiling Seth shot, and we cut to Joan of Arc being burned at the stake, what does the audience think of the story? Suddenly, who am I? Am I the happy father?
Villain.
I'm the monster who killed Joan of Arc. Now, the significance of this is that it's the same shot of me smiling. It's just what you put it next to that in the mind of the audience creates the story. This film is all about that. The camera work is chaotic, moving around. The acting is too real. It's incredibly authentic and transcendent, is how people call it. And then the editing becomes chaotic and filled with deep juxtaposition. The story comes out of Joan's face cut to this. The story comes out of the way the images are arranged and the rhythm and the pacing of the images. How long each shot is, or how short each shot is, and how they are arranged. Okay? So that's what we're gonna do today, is watch this film. Afterwards, we'll talk a little bit about it. This is the elements that go into making a story. And then I'll talk a little bit about story structure, too. And then we'll be done for the day. Any questions before we
How does this compare with the time period of the great one called All Quiet on the Western Front?
This is a similar time period, though it's earlier, okay? But that's considered one of the masterpieces as well. But this is a masterpiece in another direction, in that All Quiet on the Western Front is very much kind of a realistic film, and it's using film in a much more traditional way. And in some ways was kind of more powerful in a wide way because it resonated so deeply with people who had experienced the war. So it's a very similar time period, but this movie uses cinema in a different way, which is a big part of why I'm showing it here, is because we're used to films like All Quiet on the Western Front, which is very much what American cinema kind of now is. It's smooth. It's enticing, it pulls you in. And this movie kind of does the opposite. This movie is trying to tell the story of Joan of Arc, not as a melodrama, but as pulling you into the world as it might have been for her. Any other? Yeah.
What year was this?
28, released in 28.
How was it received by audiences?
It was well received. It was considered at the time, and then it got lost for a while, and talks a little bit about it, but this movie did pretty well, and he went on to make a lot of other movies, and this movie was considered like a good film in its time, kind of unlike in many ways this film was similar to Citizen Kane by Orson Welles, that also is an incredibly influential movie, but for a variety of reasons didn't do quite as well when it was first released. Yes.
What country was this made in?
I think it was made in England.
Okay.
I was just thinking about this, and when I was reading, yeah, that is. He's a European director.
Okay.
He's a German director.
Okay.
But I think that they actually shot it in England. But as you'll see in the film, like the actual location is like irrelevant in large part. There's one other thing, and I'm going to turn on the movie now. And we can turn off the lights. One other thing just to think about. As I've been thinking a lot about this movie, I've been thinking about this French philosopher, a French Christian philosopher called René Girard. And René Girard talks a lot about his theory on human behavior is called mimetic theory. And mimetic theory means that mainly human beings imitate each other. What we do is imitate each other all the time. And that one of the ways we deeply imitate each other is that occasionally for our collective sins, we have to pick up a scapegoat and all rally around it, that we kind of cleanse ourselves collectively by attacking one person and scapegoating one person. And Girard argues that the real power of the story of Jesus, and there's a parallel in it with the story of Joan of Arc, is that Jesus was the first innocent scapegoat who broke this really destructive pattern of human behavior of blaming all your sins on one person, and then when you killed that person or threw them out of the group, you were somehow cleansed as a people, even though you weren't really looking at the base problems. I just invite you to kind of think about that a little bit. Is the story of Joan of Arc not just about the purity and passion of her, but also about the way we ritually do this as people. Okay, and you got that. Let me just.
So if you're like me, you probably would have turned off this movie, right? If you're watching it on Netflix, in the first few minutes. It's kind of, to me, kind of like the performance of the main actress. At first you're watching it and you're like, this is kind of weird, right? And she doesn't seem exactly human and seems too extreme, and it's the same thing kind of with the structure of the movie. And then, for me at least, as the performance progresses and as you become drawn into the language of the film, the film creates its own language that draws you in. Then, at least for me, it becomes a very powerful experience. And you know, part of the reason why I elected to show this film in this context is it's the kind of movie that we almost never see anymore, where it really demands of your attention, and it becomes very powerful if you give it your attention. But if you're, you know, checking your phone and you've got a thousand other movies you could watch, it doesn't land as powerfully. And it doesn't sweep you up in the way that I think her performance really does. At first it's weird, and then it becomes this really kind of transcendent thing. You know, so for me, you know, watching all this stuff, the way the editing changes from kind of pretty solid at first and then becomes more chaotic and finally becomes really chaotic towards the end, and the cinematography, the way the camera moves and reflects the angles and above and below, and then becomes even more chaotic. I'm always watching the technique and watching how this does it. And then for me, when I see something that I consider real art is when it pulls me up out of the technique. You know, and whenever I've seen this film partway through, I end up sitting and I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, am I Joan, or am I really the tormentors, the people that are really just imitating each other and imitating each other's belief? Or what do I actually believe in? What is this thing that we consider faith? And what is this thing of actually believing in something that, you know, might even, you know, cause your death? When I think most of us, you know, won't even be inconvenienced by something, right? So that to me is art, and you know, that's why I selected the film, is when it lifts me up and starts me to thinking beyond just, oh, this is a funny film or an entertaining film, but how does this film reflect me? How does this film reflect my spiritual journey? Comments about the film, or questions about the film?
Whatever happened to the lady that played Joan of Arc?
This was really like the height of her career, and she played in some other things over the years, but she never really, I mean, this role kind of defined her, and she never really achieved great success beyond this role. So it's not an incredibly happy story for her. And she was in her mid-30s at the time, and she was a stage actress at the time, and she did not go on to have a studied career, you know, in part probably, you know, the same thing like, you know, Anthony Perkins in Psycho, where it's such a, you know, you remember that movie, mm-hmm. It's such a defining role, you know, and her performance in this is so vivid that it's hard to imagine her in anything else. Yeah.
How did the film go down at the time? I mean, was it successful?
It was pretty successful, yeah. You know, and I mean, it was seen as a major film at the time, but... you know, the big deal is it's 28, which means everything is transitioning from silent to sound. You know, and you know, that's part of why this film kind of disappeared, is that sound became the new thing, and all of a sudden that's what everybody was excited about and doing, you know. Yeah.
Were the actors during the trial actually doing the verbatim trial? Or, I mean, they were obviously talking.
I think it's a combination.
Yeah.
You know, so I would be, you know, verbatim, no.
Yeah.
But were they going through, are they being very faithful to the transcript? Yes, in an overall sense.
So they obviously had a script, it's just that most of it was not subtitled.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. And that was very common in the silent era, too, is that, you know, you'd say, mm-hmm. And then the card would be like, no. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I found myself so focused on the facial expressions and the eye movement that I sort of lost track of the story. And it occurred to me, that's sort of a lost art. I don't think we see that in today. I mean, even our supposedly greatest and highest paid actors.
Yeah.
We don't live in this country anyway. Our movies can't be very subtle, and they have to be loud and over the top and
super clear,
right?
You know, like super
and people
clear.
Have to leave feeling good.
Yeah.
Even I have friends who are socially progressive, and my wife and I are known as the couple that like to watch movies where you leave totally depressed. And there aren't very many people out there in the world that like those kind of movies.
You know, I mean, and I think that's
therefore they aren't made in the United States.
Yeah.
We usually find those kind of movies from France, Denmark, any place but the United States.
The U.S. generally tells fairy tale movies.
Yes, exactly.
In the sense that they're real clear, they're real tidy, and like everything's cool at the end. Everything's fine.
Right.
And, you know, I talk about it a lot with my students in the sense that so much of our media now is like eating a Twinkie, where it's incredibly good, it's incredibly tasty, but if that's all you eat, that's bad for you, you know?
Right.
And I think part of our challenge culturally right now is we want all of our media and all of our stories to be easily digestible, easily understandable, and also make us feel good about ourselves as the dominant country in the world, right?
Right.
The dominant people. And then this kind of stuff isn't that. It's trying to provoke you in a way that we're normally
not. Well, just as our movies, we like to feel good about ourselves. When we proclaim to be the greatest nation on earth, we fail to look at the social indicators of the developed countries of the world. In the most important categories, we're down at the bottom of the list.
Because we eat a lot of junk food.
Well, infant mortality, childhood poverty.
I mean, junk food in terms of like
we're
a lot of our
we're great pretenders.
Yes.
What country were the men of the cloth? Was that England or why?
The story. What's that? Yeah. Okay. Or what?
It's a Catholic story. It's about the Catholic Church in France.
Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt you. Do you have something more to say?
I was just wondering, that was the Catholic Church in France?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They all kind of looked Italian with those hooked noses.
Yes.
That's the actor.
Which it may have been shot in Italy. Someone, I just forgot this, so forgive me. But luckily, there's.
The mosaic was shot in France.
Yeah.
At the beginning.
It's good that we talk about all the issues that you listed over there, Albert. The movie itself is extremely moving, as to the theological implications to the Passion story. I had the experience two years ago September now, to stand at the square in Rouen, where she was burned at stake. And to read the inscriptions on there, and I wish I'd seen this movie before I'd been there. But it's just a powerful, powerful theological statement about what not to do. The whole idea of certainty in the theological outcome versus doubt and letting God take care of the issue. Powerful, powerful movie from that perspective as the story. Not necessarily all the other things you say are fine too, but you know, unless you have a good story. You can have all those other things,
that
doesn't mean much.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have a bad
book. Yeah. And I mean, that's a great, thank you so much for picking that up, because that's really kind of my point, in a sense, is that all of these techniques that I talk a bunch about, right, all they do is support that story, the larger theme, the larger message. It's the point of it all, is to say something with them. And that's how films work. Is they use all these techniques, but they use all these techniques to try to say something. Did you have a question?
I was just wondering about the aftermath of Joan. What was it like historically after she was martyred?
The what?
The effect of her martyrdom. What happened in France afterwards?
You know, I'm not an expert on the larger story, but I think it was, and you might know having just been there, but I think it was a while, and then the martyrdom kind of kicked in after.
It led to the French Revolution eventually, and raising up Joan of Arc and bringing down the monarchy in France. That's really what happened in the next 50 years after that.
Yeah.
The music seemed to fit so well, and did you say that was put with it after?
Yeah, it was made in 1995. So when they refound the movie and kind of were remaking this experience, it's not, like the director didn't pick out the music, director was long gone, but the music was sort of tailored for the film. So it's a selection of various different things that were put together
to go with the film. So it totally goes with the film.
Okay.
But it wasn't the director doing it. It was when the film was restored.
I found it rather interesting seeing the subject matter of the film and the fact that this copy was found in a Norwegian mental institution.
I know, it's great. Yeah.
Belonged to one of the patients?
They lost it, yeah. No, I think they just bought it. I think they don't know where it came from.
Did Siskel and Ebert give it two thumbs up?
Yeah, Ebert certainly did.
Ebert did.
Yeah, I'm sure Siskel liked it too.
You know, in a sense, I mean, it's very old and it's primitive in a lot of ways, but it's incredibly modern too. I mean, you know, it sort of just hits you as, like just incredibly modern.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is kind of part of why I selected this film too. Is this what I'm thinking about so much lately? Is how, you know, and that the extreme topicalness and timeliness of the Bible and Bible stories and these kind of stories of faith and how it just keeps, it is the present. The human condition has not changed that much. We're still living through these same cycles.
Well, and the representations themselves, you know, and it was sort of like the way you prepped it for it, I think, was right. I mean, it's really, really powerful and really, really modern.
Yeah.
And particularly the coldness in the eyes of the church people.
Yeah.
It strikes me that it's the same coldness I see in the eyes of the Catholic Church leaders today who allow children to be sexually abused.
Yeah.
But I sense towards the end, though, that they really wanted her to live. They really wanted her to confess and to live. I think towards the end they were just like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I sense that it wasn't so black.
They were trying to give her an out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the out, of course, was
wasn't something she
renounced.
But they were so stuck in that.
Mm-hmm.
They gave her many chances.
Over and over again. Like, just, you know, put on a dress.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Good news, we're not going to excommunicate you. We're just going to punish you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's impossible now, I think, not to see it without a feminist kind of an angle on it.
You know, and the whole, like, LGBTQ thing with the dress, you know what I mean? It never totally occurred to me with this story until I was watching it here in a room with you guys. That's a different angle than, like, that, you know, we, you know, maybe don't traditionally think of it that way.
It seemed like when I was watching, sometimes I thought I could read their lips.
Yeah.
And then I also noticed that she had eyeliner on.
I don't think she did. According to the thing, she didn't. But that it was so brutal on her that, like, she became discolored over the film.
Yeah.
But maybe
she did.
Seems
like maybe the black went out a little bit beyond her.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It would be very much like a filmmaker too to say we didn't use makeup and actually use makeup. That'd be very much like what a filmmaker would do. Tomorrow night at 8 o'clock is another really uplifting film called The Virgin Spring, which is by Ingmar Bergman, who is one of our most famous directors. And this one has audio to it. It's at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, and it is a story kind of you know, the old pagan religions and Christianity colliding and what comes out of it. And it's, again, not a super long film, a dark film with some pretty graphic stuff in it, but also that delves really into some deep questions and deep stories. And then on Thursday morning, on 10:15, we'll be watching a much more modern and much more conventionally accessible film called The Apostle, that was written and directed by Robert Duvall. And is just a wonderfully engaging and accessible film. Thank you very much, folks.
For sure.
Yeah.
How close to the time of his death was he in 1968?
He had been gone for a while.
Well,
he was like kind of coming for the weekend sometime. They kind of moved on from the Chicago movement. King had moved on at that time.
though his team was still in place doing a lot of stuff.
What was the work he was doing in Chicago under?
It really, more than anything, was trying to combat urban, more than anything, trying to combat the problems of urban poverty. And it was him really trying to engage with that, which is a huge thing. So when you look at the arc of Dr. King's career, Selma, Montgomery, right, really huge victories against Jim Crow, really in a remarkable way stopped Jim Crow. And then after that, after those laws got changed, which was, this came after like 50, 60 years of war, on the parts of people getting work, he repositioned and moved towards confronting urban poverty and the problems that are associated with urban poverty that truly affected the black community in this country. So this was kind of a whole new chapter of problems. It can be argued pretty clearly that those problems were now just starting to deal with. They're massively complicated problems. And it's like the Poor People's Campaign and all that. This was a new direction that King was going in, at that direction.